You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, candy won, candy won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Communications Workers 6360 and International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 124. The Communications Workers of America Local 6360 represents workers at AT&T, Landtel Communications, Rogers Printing, E2 Embroidery, Mood Media, and 911 dispatchers for the City of Independence and Jackson County. We work every day to protect workers' rights. Buying union-made products helps us all keep good jobs. And the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We have been wiring Kansas City since 1905. If you're not finding your electrical contractor at IBEW124.org, then you're not getting the best value for your money. We thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, in her new book, Chow Chop Suey, food historian Anne Mendelson traces the history of the Chinese in America through food in Chinese restaurants. It's a story of how xenophobia stunted the enrichment of both our society and our cuisine. Then, going to the polls on April 4th, confused about the 1/8 cent sales tax? Listen to both sides and decide for yourself. In the news, what are unions saying about the Gorsuch nomination? And Missouri Senate to resume testimony on bill gutting anti-discrimination law. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg. We'll find out about his interview with Richard Trumka. So we're going to hear Trumka on Trump. That's AFL-CIO President Trumka on Trump and Obama. Now for the news.
This is the news from our side, March 30th, 2017. The Missouri Senate has just scheduled a hearing at 1 p.m. Monday on a bill, SB 43, that would significantly weaken Missouri's anti-discrimination laws if passed. This is the hearing which was suspended after the president of the Missouri NAACP was silenced. This bill will affect minority groups and immigrants tremendously. The changes to Missouri's discrimination law would end up shielding harassers and racist managers because it exempts from the term employer, quote, an individual employed by an employer, unquote. That means that you sue the business, restaurant, etc., but not the person who discriminated against you because of your age, gender, race, etc. So even if you win your suit against the company, the perpetrator of discrimination could move on to another company and do it again. Nor could you sue the manager individually, as SB 43 says that it is the exclusive remedy for any issues arising in the workplace. So if passed, SB 43 makes it impossible to hold the person who actually commits an unlawful act liable for their actions. This provision shields the actual wrongdoer from being held responsible for their inappropriate and harassing behavior in the workplace. The person who has suffered from discrimination and subsequently terminated for the wrongdoer's behavior has no recourse against the actual wrongdoer. Finally, Senate Bill 43 also specifically excludes managers, supervisors, and anyone who is paid to report on the business activity from whistleblowing protection.
The Kansas City Star reprinted a New York Times article asking who is winning the race for jobs between robots and humans. Unfortunately for humans, robots won. Two economists who at first said humans were winning have changed their minds and now say that for every robot per 1,000 workers, up to 6 workers lose their jobs and wages fall by as much as 3/4%. This, according to Darren Acemoglu of MIT and Pasquale Restrepo of Boston University. Previously, these same professors thought robots actually helped create better jobs. But now, they say, data shows that's not true. And the people who lose the most are mainly blue-collar men without a college degree. The study found that we can blame robots for as many as 670,000 lost manufacturing jobs between 1990 and 2007. Industrial robots are expected to quadruple, too, in the near future. Plus, there will be new job-costing technology with self-driving cars, machine learning, and drones. All this adds fuel to the debate about whether it's trade and offshoring of jobs or automation that's destroying the blue-collar middle class, and whether President Trump's promise to bring back lost jobs is as empty as his plans to ban Muslims.
The Senate will likely vote on the nomination of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court next week. We thought we'd tell you what some unions are saying about him. The communications workers testified against him and said Gorsuch's past rulings put him squarely in the camp of corporations and against workers. Teamsters President Jimmy Hoffa said Gorsuch has rules wrong on the authority of the National Labor Relations Board and the Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission. Hoffa predicted Gorsuch will rule against worker rights and public employee rights. AFSCME President Lee Saunders dislikes Gorsuch because he's ruled that corporations are people, and also because of his ruling in favor of firing the truck driver who saved his life when marooned in sub-zero temperatures. Steelworkers President Leo Girard dismissed Gorsuch as a one percenter who decides in favor of moneyed interests, while National Nurses United co-presidents Deborah Berger and Gene Ross said they think he's a man driven by ideology. And that ideology certainly isn't one of working people. They mentioned a case involving Compass Environmental Incorporated, which Gorsuch opposed, upholding a federal fine against a company that failed to adequately train a worker who was electrocuted. Teachers President Randy Weingarten said she gave Gorsuch credit for being amiable and intelligent, but he sides with corporations and powerful special interests over working people, consumers, students, and women. The National Education Association sent a library paraprofessional, Kim McIntosh, from Blue Springs, Missouri to D.C. to lobby senators against Gorsuch because the judge does not accord legally required services to disabled students. She said, Judge Gorsuch's rulings have been brutally against making it easier for these students to have a clearer path or an easier time getting an appropriate, accessible education, said McIntosh. I think that's completely backward. And finally, Service Employees President Mary Kay Henry said, Judge Gorsuch's record of opinions disqualifies him. She mentioned the truck driver with frozen brakes, too, and said that Gorsuch's testimony shows he isn't the kind of judge who gives working people a fair shot at justice. These reactions were assembled by PAI, and unions are asking their members to call their senators and tell them to vote no on Gorsuch. The news tonight was read by Chris Mann, Judy Ansel, and I'm Jen Zaman.
peasant, but the worker's dead. We have given our best just to give you rest, so you can lie on crimson wool. But if blood be the price of all your wealth, then we have paid in full. There is never a mind-blown
Forum.
I'm Jacob White.
Joining me now is Ann Mendelson, and her new book is called Chow Chop Suey, Food and the Chinese-American Journey. And Ann is a very accomplished food historian who has written for the New York Times dining section and the LA Times food section, in addition to writing some other interesting books, one of which is about milk. So Ann, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So your new book is about what you call the first crossover cuisine, which is chop suey. And so I was hoping today that we could talk a little bit about what factors went into chop suey becoming the first crossover cuisine. But maybe first we should just talk about a very basic question, which is, what is a crossover cuisine?
I think that today most people have such a strong idea of what a crossover cuisine is that they never bothered to define it.
Okay.
But from my point of view, it would be a cuisine that appeals across ethnic boundaries, and especially is a cuisine that makes its way from the sort of mainstream white or white-dominated culture into, or the other way around, that makes its way from an ethnic community into the general white-dominated culture.
And so the people who came to California, to the San Francisco area from China, the first people who came in the 1850s, you write that they were very well equipped to run restaurants in San Francisco. And so could you talk a little bit about their life in China? Had they interacted with Westerners before? And what other factors went into them being able to adapt quickly to running restaurants in California?
Well, these people were mostly from Guangdong province, Canton province, in southern China. And during the 19th century, Canton province was just racked by terrible wars, natural disasters. There were many, many reasons to leave this sort of disaster area and come to a place that offered possibly more peace and quiet and jobs. Already, these people in the southern part of Guangdong province, they had become accustomed to dealing with foreign traders. First the English, the Portuguese and the English, later Americans. And they were accustomed to cooking for them. Westerners in China were just amazed at how quickly Chinese men, these women did not interact with the foreigners, Chinese men had an incredible knack for picking up the essentials of Western cuisines, French and English and American. And so they came to San Francisco during the gold rush with already some track record of knowing what, knowing how to appeal to Western preferences. And among these first newcomers were many laboring men who were just looking for jobs. They were looking for manual work, but also there were wheelers and dealers. There were people who were used to setting up restaurants. They were used to interacting with the British in Hong Kong. They knew their way around a ledger or a sort of. They knew how to organize projects and make money from them. So they instantly started setting up restaurants in San Francisco, and they were very good at it. They were very good at pleasing the non-Chinese gold rushers who came from all parts of the world and, of course, all parts of the United States. Chinese restaurants in San Francisco were some of the first really popular and successful restaurants.
And another contribution that you mentioned that these Chinese immigrants make to California was switching from being a gold-based economy to agriculture. So could you talk a little bit about the different gardening and farming projects that Chinese immigrants took up when they were in California?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have to say, first of all, that the honeymoon didn't last long. At first, Chinese were welcomed just like anybody else. But they happened to come along at a very difficult time in the history of American labor movements. In fact, a very racist time in the history of labor movements. So they got hounded out of gold work once they would strike a good vein. Some white person would come along and throw them out. They then were able to find work on the railroad, on the transcontinental railroads that were being built then, to the great disgust of white laborers who themselves were not terribly interested in this work but were highly incensed when the Union Pacific hired a whole bunch of Chinese as construction workers. The railroads came to an end, and then the Chinese found work clearing the swamps, the delta, the San Joaquin Delta, which was very promising agricultural land, but it was totally covered with very difficult to manage vegetation that had sunk roots deep into this spongy peat soil. The Chinese cleared the land for some decades until steam equipment took over. They were the first people to clear land on a scale that would make California agribusiness, or anyhow the beginnings of it, possible. People were just astonished at the cleverness of these workers, and for their small size, these people were frequently no more than 5 feet tall. They were strong. They were capable. They knew how to organize a project. People were just white people amazed at how they buckled down to the task of clearing land. Afterwards, when agribusiness was getting off the ground in California, for a time they found a lot of work in vineyards, orchards, many kinds of farms, but again, they fell afoul of the young American labor movement, which was very much bound up with the idea that jobs, American jobs, should be held by Americans, white Americans, and these yellow interlopers should be driven back to China where they came from.
And so a lot of that pressure winds up turning into legislation. Could you tell us a little bit about the Chinese Exclusion Act?
Yeah, after some years of labor leaders campaigning to have the Chinese thrown out, Congress finally passed a law in 1882, the first law in the history of the country, and I think the only one, even now, that specifically barred citizens of one country from ever becoming citizens of this country, from being naturalized citizens. Later, the Japanese got almost as bad treatment, but the Chinese were the first and still the worst treated by American legislative institutions. So this act barred laborers, specifically manual laborers, from coming to the United States. If you had some other job, some other profession, if you were maybe a lawyer, not that there were many Chinese lawyers, if you were a teacher or student or a merchant, you were eligible to come into the country, although not to become a citizen, because at this time only white people were eligible for naturalized citizenship. The Exclusion Act was renewed several times. It was renewed in 1892. It was renewed in different forms several times in the 20th century until after World War I. There was so much general sentiment against immigrants of almost all kinds, not just Chinese, that in 1924, a general act of Congress was passed to clamp down on immigration from almost everywhere in the known universe.
And this keeps on going until the 1960s, where again we see sort of a combination of activism and then legislation changing the perceptions maybe that white America has of Chinese people. So could we talk first a little bit about, I know that the labor exclusion led people to have to be only in certain industries. So you mentioned laundries and restaurants. And could you talk a little bit about how that played out, especially as people are leaving, as Chinese immigrants are leaving California and moving into small towns and moving to the Midwest and the East Coast?
Yes. California and the West Coast became very dangerous places for Chinese laborers to be. There were lynchings, there was a lot of arson, there was just general activism to get these yellow people out of town and drive them where they would not bother honest California workers. So Chinese people started moving east to save their own lives. This was in the late 1870s, throughout the 1880s and 90s, and they came to the Midwest, they came to Chicago, they came to New York and founded another big Chinatown to compete with San Francisco Chinatown, and they also moved into the boondocks, into small towns, to found small businesses, because if you were a laborer, if somebody from the immigration authorities caught you, chopping wood or hauling coal, you were liable to be deported. But if you had your own laundry business and were washing laundry, after a lot of discussion among immigration authorities, it was decided that that qualified as a business. You were a businessman, and you were not subject to deportation. Laundry business kind of petered out because of mechanization after a while and home laundry machines. But restaurants turned out to be an even more promising and more durable line of work. And the Chinese also had either the good luck or the good sense to invent. They were the first immigrants to invent a whole cuisine based upon their own cuisine, but not identical to it. They invented a whole cuisine that appealed to white patrons, also, it turned out, to black American patrons, but first of all, to whites. It had some elements of original Cantonese cuisine, but it pushed a whole lot of other different buttons for Americans who had never tasted any Chinese cuisine. And once they tasted something that was vaguely akin to their other preferences, they said, yes, this is it.
Yeah, that reminds me, actually, as we're winding down, and I'm sorry we didn't get to talk a little more about the food part of your new book. This is Ann Mendelsohn, and we're talking about Chow Chop Suey, Food and the Chinese-American Journey. We've really been focusing on the Chinese-American journey, but I just want to say, you know, as a Jewish person, I always thought that the reason Jewish people like Chinese food was because it was open on Christmas and Christmas Eve. But you mentioned that the combination of sugar and vinegar is something that people share between where Ashkenazi Jews were in Eastern Europe and Chinese food. And so could you talk just a little bit, that was really interesting, but about what sort of specific elements, I know that soy sauce and beef are two of them, made Chinese food for Americans, like specific to the American palate?
Well, as you mentioned, there was sweet and sour, the combination of sugar and vinegar that struck a chord with people from Eastern Europe, Jews and others, and also with many Americans. Sugar was coming to be, sugar in savory dishes was coming to be a more important element of American taste. And Chinese put a lot more sugar in the chop suey dishes than they would have put in stir-fry dishes among themselves. They started using more soy sauce so that things could be colored a nice rich brown. Many people, many Americans, if they go to a Chinese restaurant and order fried rice, and it isn't brown, if it's white, they think there's something wrong with it, where Cantonese would think the other way. Americans liked gravies, thickened gravies, and they liked sauces that were sort of somewhere between a gravy and a library paste, heavily thickened. So the sauces in dishes, in the stir-fry dishes in the chop suey restaurants, they came to be very thick, very gloppy, and very sweet, and usually colored brown, which Americans found appetizing.
Wow. Yeah, very interesting. And there's so much more in this book. Again, we've been talking with Ann Mendelsohn about Chow Chop Suey, Food and the Chinese-American Journey. Ann, thank you so, so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right.
The GOP's failure to replace Obamacare opens the opportunity to debate Medicare for all.
Progressives pressure Senate Democrats to block Neil Gorsuch.
Opponents say the Atlantic Coast Pipeline will deepen the climate crisis.
All that and a summary of the week's underreported news on Between the Lines, Friday morning at 9.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum at KKFI. The music you just heard is Money, Money, Money by ABBA. This is Joyce McCauley and Sean Saving hosting tonight's show. Our topic this session will focus on question number 4, the Central City Economic Development Sales Tax. This will appear on the April 4th ballot. The One City Initiative will impose a 1/8 sales tax in Kansas City to provide funds to develop parts of the East Side. We reached out to the organizations who oppose this tax, but they were unable to participate in tonight's discussion. The opposition is concerned about the lack of available details and the oversight of the money. We are very happy, though, to have Reverend Sam Mann, pastor emeritus at St. Mark's Union Church and vice president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference with us tonight. And we're just happy that he's here to help us unwrap some of the details of question 4.
Good evening, Joyce. It's good to be here with you and Sean.
Yeah, thank you for being on, Sam. So I want to get right into this. Why, you know, while Kansas City has several kinds of tax incentive programs that have funded, you know, dozens of projects, this would be the first such program where a specific region is funded by a citywide sales tax, I believe. So why have you chosen this route to fund development in the Prospect Corridor? Why not utilize one of the existing funding sources, such as the tax increment financing?
Well, because, to be very brief, is the tax increment financing doesn't work in the inner city, and they are really financial tools that the wealthy use. They use the votes from the inner city. And the inner city has voted for almost everyone that's ever been, the zoo, whatever. And with the promise that it would go and trickle down, you know, to the east of Troost. But if you've been over there lately, you'll understand that we don't live in just one city. There are two cities. There's the one city that's economically stable, economically prosperous, and economically on the move. But the east side of Kansas City is dilapidated, vacant lots, torn down houses, terrible streets, crime infested, you name it in terms of the lack of development. The interesting part about this is that we're using a tool called the initiative petition, and it's a legal tool. I'm sure you've heard about right. This idea grew out of the neighborhood. Like, we've supported everything else, but it's not trickling down. You know, like the Brush Creek Corridor, you know, they convinced the folks and the black community and those who live in those wards and districts all voted for, majority voted for, like, the Brush Creek Corridor, and they said, let us develop the plaza area first, but then we'll, as the water, Brush Creek flows on through the east side will continue to develop. Well, I don't know if you've been over there to see that, but it's we have most of Johnson County and the Plaza Trash,
right?
East of Truth.
Yeah, east of Truth doesn't really. They haven't really done much with Brush Creek.
No.
So what's? I guess what would you say to those? You know, particularly say folks north of the river or something who may have never set foot in the east side, may never will. Why should they pay for a 8-cent sales tax for a part of the city that they don't live in?
Well, you know, I mentioned we're not one city, we're two cities, but the city that we're talking about, this part east of Truce, is the spine of the city, and we know that if the spine in your back is misfunctioning, diseased, the whole body's going to be. And so we know that poverty and disrepair. I'm looking for a word here, but they breed crime. And so what we wind up doing is protecting ourselves. The rest of the city does, from east of Truce. We know over half of the drive-by shootings that Chief Forte talked about here about a month ago are in this area. So that's a direct relationship between poverty and despair and these kinds of conditions. So it's not just like you're not taking care of yourself. But we are one city too, right? You know, and when the vote comes for the rest of the city, they come to the east side to get the votes, and they've gotten them. So the people in there said, "Well, let's put one out here for us." You know, they hadn't been trickling down.
Okay, and then I think a lot of people are real interested in exactly how much money this program would raise, and then how are the funds going to be allocated.
I want to say one other thing, if I could, about this point. We've received a lot of energy and support from people from outside this district, a lot, when we've made presentations and everything. Folks are saying it's time. We were the Kansas City Star endorsed this on this very point. It's time. It's time for us to pay attention to it, not just to invest in the plaza, which we invest in the plaza. I mean, that's one area.
Oh, yeah.
That's, you know, Crown Center is just one. You don't raise that question when you do that, you know, when we go there. But we do, in fact, there's been a lot of support from it, and people are saying that it's time. So now, back to your question, what was...
We'd like to know how much money is expected to be raised annually, and then how are the funds to be allocated?
Okay. The money will be, we estimate, $1,600,000 a year. $10,600,000 a year is what it is. Did I say that right?
That makes...
Yeah, it's $10,600,000 a year. That's what will be raised over 10 years. That's $100 million plus. When you figure what's needed there, it's a pittance. But it is something to get us started. And this will be leveraged capital, as they say, in our economic system. It'll be leveraged to leverage other monies there, you know, to develop east of Truth, housing, businesses, and those kinds of things, you know, to come into the inner city. You can't just build a grocery store when there's no other economic development going on.
So the idea is to get some other economic development going on before those kinds of stores or businesses are set up.
Yeah, it will be a multifaceted thing. It can be used for housing. It can be used for economic development, mainly economic development, we think, because the economic development will will generate
and
the
so
housing.
What do you mean by economic development?
Yeah. Economic development would be businesses, not just consumer office buildings. You know, it would be businesses, law offices, places like you see in other areas of the city. Maybe a department store. You see,
okay,
this kind of thing. It won't be just a shopping center. It can be used for leveraging and bringing folks in, partnering with folks, you know, to bring in some educational institutions. There was a talk of an incubator type thing to help folks who live there to learn business skills and that kinds of those kinds of things. I don't know if you've been there, but the sidewalks are mostly vacant.
And then who will oversee the money?
Okay. There's a five-member commission.
Okay. And how is that commission going to be put together?
Okay, there's a five-member commission, and the three are appointed by the mayor, who opposes this thing, by the way. Three are appointed by the mayor. This is all law, I think, that we have to abide by for state law. Three are appointed by the mayor. One from the city council, from the school district, and one from the county. So there are five. It's a five-member commission. The beauty in this is that they are by law required to spend this money within the confines of 8th Street on the north, Gregory on the south, Paseo on the west, and Indiana on the east. They can't spend this money anywhere else, and it has to be for economic and community development. It can't be for anything else. That means that they are subject to be sued if they don't spend it right. You understand what I'm saying? So we will be watching this with eagle and hawk eyes from the neighborhoods that want to stabilize this, because we know right now this is being gentrified and regentrified in a fast way.
Will there be requirements imposed on recipients of this money, or will there be public input into exactly what we expect from a developer or a business that gets this money? And I'm talking about, you know, the contractors that may be building things, or the business that comes in and gets some of this tax money. Will they be expected to hire local people? Will there be a certain minimum pay that, or benefits that they're expected to pay? I mean, is this to be determined, or what's the process for public input on that sort of thing?
The public input, of course, is the Human Relations Department of the Kansas City, Missouri, which is bound. The city is bound by law to hire, EEOC type things. Now, what we're going to do is one of the purposes of this thing is to hire neighborhood folks.
Well, I guess that's what I'm saying.
If this is
money being given to a private entity, then the EEOC only has so much say in what that money gets done.
There's a percentage. That's correct. But you can believe that we will watchdog this, and the goal is to hire the folks in the neighborhood. That's the goal.
Will there be minority contractor requirements?
Oh yes. Now, what they will be and what those percentages will be, we don't know. But we know there will be. The human relations in the city has a minority contract percentage,
right,
that they have to do. I built a building there once, a $5 million building, and we had 43%. Now, what will save this project is, one, the law, you know, the law that we will enforce if they don't do what we want them to do, but it will be watched all by the community. And one of the goals of the community and in all this is the making of stabilizing, you know, the folks that are there, and hiring them and that kind of thing.
Because I think some of the concerns that have happened with previous TIF projects or tax abatements that the city has done is that there were no community benefits agreements put in place. I mean, Mayor Funkhauser ran on that. And then they put together a commission that came up with some guidelines that never became enforceable law. There are policy guidelines. And I think that's probably one of the concerns that people have here is, how do we know that we're not just going to give money to a McDonald's for another $8 an hour job?
Well,
if I said there was specifics in there to do this, I would be lying to you. Right. But to tell you the community benefits,
Community Benefits Agreements.
Community Benefits Agreement is in our agenda already.
Okay.
And the folks that put this petition together, that will be one of the first things on the agenda in terms when the commission is put together. And those are the kind of conversation we're having. Now, is it specifically in the law, right? I can't say that it is, but this is a new thing.
Okay.
The citizens have done it. And I know these citizens, this petition was not signed by folks outside this area. It was signed by folks inside this area. They're going to watch
it. So you expect them to hold people accountable?
Oh, we're going to hold it. That's right. Thank you for them words. The folks that are in this are activists who will hold folks accountable, and the community benefits agreement is already a part of the initial conversation here.
Right. You are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, and we are discussing the One City Initiative that will be on the Kansas City, Missouri ballot next Tuesday. That's issue four?
Yes, it is. Issue number four.
Our guest tonight is Sam Mann from the Southern Christian Leadership Council.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just really enjoying this discussion. We'd like to know also, are there already projects lined up? Have you been talking to contractors or people who work on within the field of economic development, as you're talking about? Have you already talked to folks?
There's a lot of conversation, as you can imagine. There are folks calling, wanting to talk. Is there anything specific lined up? No. That's not something you can put on a ballot. You can't go ahead and say we got. I think that the notion is to stop the gentrification by the will of the people in this area, I know that there are specific projects and conversations taking place. For example, the incubator that I mentioned, somebody has already come forward with it. But are we negotiating? No, there's an art district talking. But are we negotiating? No, there's a office building. Are we? No, you can't negotiate till you're ready to go. But yes, there are conversations taking place.
There are three other big bond issues on the ballot next Tuesday. The city has been pushing heavily. I've gotten 20 mailers, I think, already for them, for infrastructure improvements. Do you think that those are going to have a negative? I mean, that's going to be a property tax issue. Do you think that those are going to have a negative impact on the One City Initiative?
I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see. We certainly don't have the money. I think they raised about $800,000 just to do this campaign. We're grassroots,
right?
We're strictly grassroots, and we think we've got an idea that whose time has come, and we think that the town ought to recognize it and step up and put this money in the. Yes, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You said
one. About the bond issues. One of the things that, we'd really like to know if our listeners have any more questions. Who can they contact?
Oh, let's see. I could give them my telephone number. Call 842-5454 at Southern Christian Leadership Conference. That would
842-5454.
Yeah.
That's 816 area code.
816 area code, yes.
Do you have a website? Is there a...
There's no, no, no we're, no we're, okay. we're, now we have a, no, we don't have a website. I know we've used some media type things to get the word out, but we are strictly a grassroots on the ground
organization.
And we should say, I guess the Star did run, that was on Sunday's paper?
Yes.
So if folks can read the Sunday Star opinion page, there is a pro... our article on there, so that's I'll give you some more information about the right. initiative. We still have 2 minutes. Wow, we got a little extra time. Okay, so what has the? So you said this was mostly done by the folks on the east side.
Yes.
I live just east of, just west of Troost. I haven't seen a sign or anything for it. Are there?
We don't have that.
You didn't have that kind of money.
This is pure spirit. It's pure on the ground.
We got the initiative petitions, but the point is, it feels so righteous, and folks realize that this truth in this, that's the Star endorsed it. I mean, the Star not only endorsed it, but there were two big articles by Diane Stafford, mm-hmm. who wrote about the in a very favorable light, in a very you know what I mean. So, no, we don't have much money. We're like the old days.
How have you been getting your message across, though, to voters for?
Well,
we've
been going to every community organization, neighborhood organization that we can, and we've been to mm-hmm. hundred of those, and we've talked to the Star, we've talked to y'all, we use public media. Oh, I see. Okay.
So all right. Well, are you ready, Judy? You got your gun? All right.
Okay. Well, thank you for being here, and thank you for helping us get the information out to our voters. And I want to say good night.
Well, thank you for having me here. And let me just say, I was one of the almost beginners at KKFI many years ago when this radio.
We were one of those people everywhere in the city.
Yes.
Thank you very much. This is the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving. This has been Sam Mann from the Southern Christian Leadership Council.
Conference.
That's right. Conference. Thank you very much.
So thank you very much.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel, and we've got Washington Window on Workers coming up with Mark Grunberg, who obviously is in Washington. How you doing, Mark?
Well, I'm doing fine, even if I'm in the middle of en route between everything, so let's go ahead.
Okay. Well, okay, so you had the privilege of interviewing Richard Trumka this week and writing about it. Mark, who's Richard Trumka?
He's the president of the AFL-CIO, so he's the leader of the larger of the two union federations, and basically he's the voice of much of unionized working America and ununionized working America, because unions also speak up for ununionized workers as well.
Okay. And so you asked him, mostly it looks like from your article, about his assessment of Barack Obama's presidency, but then at the end you also
right.
asked him about what he thinks about Donald Trump. So let's start with Obama. He actually gave Obama a grade. What was the grade he got?
Well, it was a split grade. For intent and intention, he gave him an A. He liked the policies that were being put forward, but for execution, it fluctuated between a B minus and a C plus.
In so many words,
things didn't work out as everybody thought they would work out, because Obama wasn't as good on the follow through.
Yeah. Okay. So he had a lot of blame to pass around to the Republicans for blocking Obama's agenda, but he also had some things to say about Obama. Why did Obama fail? Did he say?
He failed for a couple of reasons, or rather, maybe it would be incomplete would be a better way of putting it. First, he had to come. First, Obama believed in his first term he could still work with the Republicans. It took until near the end of his first term to realize that their opposition was going to be absolutely implacable and unshakable, and he couldn't work with them. The second part was he had to compromise with people within his own party who didn't want to go as far for workers as he did. The Senate equivalent, if you will, of the Blue Dogs, and the more conservative Democrats, the more business-oriented Democrats. And third, it was a case of also trying to handle a lot of stuff at the same time, and choosing a, the first priority, of course, was to pull us out of the Great Recession, which he did. And the, but then his second priority was health care reform, and that he spent his political capital, almost all of it, on health care reform, leaving very little for anything else, including workers' rights.
You know, he had some interesting things to say about what Obama did or didn't do on immigration reform. And basically, he said that, you know, Obama thought that he would be able to get immigration reform if he coddled the Republican desire to have more enforcement. And so he became basically deporter in chief, but the Republicans didn't fulfill their part of the deal, and we never got immigration reform. And it sounds like that was, you know, he thought Obama's judgment was really faulty in that.
Yeah, the phrase Rich Trumka used was he took the bait.
Right, right. And another thing he said that was really interesting was that he said that the appointment of Merrick Garland at the end of the Obama administration to fill Scalia's seat on the Supreme Court was a coup d'etat. What did he mean by that?
He meant that basically the Senate Senate Republicans decided to ignore the Constitution and not even give Garland a hearing. You know, they ignored the advice and consent functions of the Constitution and just basically deep-sixed the nomination, and they shouldn't have.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting concept to call it a coup d'etat, I think. Okay, so what is he? Real quickly, we only have a few seconds left. What's his assessment of Trump?
His assessment of Trump is that the guy is that when you get him one-on-one, and Trump has met him twice one-on-one, the guy listens. He's not the blowhard you see in public, and even if he doesn't agree, he's at least willing to listen to what you have to say. So Trumka made two very key points: the right of every worker, union and non-union, to better him or herself by organizing, and not to do anything to increase income inequality in the country. But then, as Rich said at the end, these are just words. There are a lot of words. What will happen is what will be the proof is what actually happens in policy.
Sounds like you must be in an airport or something. So
China subway station. Yes.
Okay, we're going to let you go. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you next month.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, we've been talking to Mark Grunberg, who edits. The Union Press Associates in Washington, D.C. And now for the calendar.
This is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for March 30th, 2016. Watch At the River I Stand about Memphis sanitation worker strike and Dr. King's assassination. That's Tuesday, April 4th, 7 p.m. at the Gem Theater, 1615 East 18th Street, KCMO. Reserve tickets at info@standupkc.org. People's Climate Movement Rally, Saturday, April 29th, 1 to 3 p.m., Washington Square, Pershing and Grand, KCMO, sponsored by Sierra Club, 350.org, among others. Check out the Heartland Labor Forum schedule at www.heartland.forum, where you can also listen to today's show.
And that's heartlandlaborforum.org. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is The Challenge Manufacturing Strike Victory and From Male to Female, How One Engineer Learned About Discrimination. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zeman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.